Peter Marks, drama critic of the Washington Post.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write about theater for the New York Times, the New Yorker, and Newsday.
And I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the seventh episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America.
We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
Peter and I are speaking to you from New York City.
And I'm in Houston, Texas, where I'm directing a new production of my first play, Satchmo at the Waldorf, which opens at the Alley Theater on February 28th, and where I spoke the other day to a group of theater majors at the University of Houston, several of whom told me that they're fans of Three on the Isle. Greetings to you all. As for the Alley, the fact that it's doing Satchmo is a reminder that theaters all over America really do produce new and newish plays, and they even get done on Broadway from time to time.
But not, Terry, consistently, and not often enough. Except for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, the two-parter that's coming this spring, not a single new straight play is opening on Broadway in the second half of the 2017-18 theater season. Instead, we're going to be seeing a string of revivals of well-known plays of the past, including St. Joan, The Iceman Cometh, Angels in America, Travesties, and the long-awaited Broadway premieres of Edward Albee's Three Tall Women and Kenny Lonergan's Lobby Hero.
So in many ways, I mean, this is a very impressive-looking season. It's ambitious, it's diverse, but if you think new work and revivals of less familiar plays are the creative lifeblood of American theater, well, then it's not that impressive. And when you look at what America's regional theaters are performing these days, you've got to wonder, are producers and artistic directors playing it too safe?
We'll be grappling with that question later on. First, though, we'd like to pay tribute to a much-admired Broadway actor, Jan Maxwell, who died recently at the age of 61. Like most stage actors, she wasn't well-known to the public at large, but within the profession, she was a legend. 13 Broadway shows, 5 Tony nominations. I never saw her give a bad performance, and I never heard anybody say a bad word about her. All three of us wrote about Maxwell many times, and when I heard the news of her passing, the first thing that occurred to me was that I'd seen and reviewed her in plenty of plays in which she was pretty much one of the few things worth talking about. I can't tell you how many shows I panned, but made an exception for Jan Maxwell. 16 Wounded, To Be or Not to Be, The Royal Family, the list goes on and on. No matter what was happening around her on stage, she always made a strong impression. That's a good working definition of a true professional. And when the show was great, well, you still noticed her. You couldn't not notice her. She was that good. Peter, I believe Maxwell figures especially prominently in your personal memory bank of unforgettable nights at the theater.
Oh, totally. What a sad moment this is. And let me just say, the fact that Broadway is not dimming its lights in every theater for her is a travesty.
Yeah, they have some kind of weird, half-assed...
Yeah, one theater.
One theater, yeah.
Although apparently others are joining in, but it's pathetic.
What is that? I mean, you know, it's not just that she's a great professional. She really was a force in the modern American theater. And I think that, you know, there are actors who are chameleons, there are actors who play themselves, and then there are actors who sort of embody a radiant energy that they can keep transforming of a different sort. And I think that sort of was what she did in all kinds of things. You know, she was nominated for a Tony in every acting category an actress can be eligible for. Yeah. Musicals and straight plays. This is not a usual occurrence in the theater. That alone makes her remarkable. And the range from of things I saw her in, from The Countess in The Sound of Music to The Hostess in City of Conversation, was just an astounding array of often characters who were very elegant in one way or another, but she could transform that elegance into something very caustic or ironic or sultry. It was a very wonderful thing to see her do this over and over again. She was tremendously committed to the work, too. And I interviewed her on two occasions The second of which was for her performance as Phyllis in Follies, which started at the Kennedy Center and then moved to Broadway. And on that occasion, you know, she talked about dropping a note to the choreographer, Warren Carlyle, and saying, "I'm not a dancer, but really, kill me, put me through it." And he did. He killed her. I mean, you know, she admitted that it was like, you know, you might get what you wish for. And but again, it was an indication of the multifaceted way in which she worked. Every part was 110%, which paid off for us.
Well, for me, one of the things that I really admired was her commitment. One of the things she did towards the end of her career, because we should also say that she had retired. She had announced her retirement from the stage in 2015.
Right.
I think to everybody, to a lot of people's surprise.
Yes.
Because she seemed to be doing well, but
yeah.
It was such a depressing moment when she said, she felt stuck. She felt she wasn't getting anywhere. That
right,
is so
right.
depressing to me. So she had retired, and I think, like a lot of people, I was waiting for a comeback. I thought someone would offer her a great part, and she would be like, "Oh yeah, this is worth it. I'm going to do it." But anyway, so towards the end of her career, she was very committed to doing shows with the Potomac Theater Project,
right.
Which usually rents out the smaller Atlantic Theater, which is really, if you haven't been there, it's a tiny little theater, so deep underground you have to take like an elevator down. It's like a you know, anti-nuclear bunker in there. And she was very committed to doing plays by Howard Barker specifically, who's a very kind of difficult British playwright. It's not produced very much here other than by PTP. And she was 150% behind those tiny little
mm-hmm.
shows, and she was for the takes. I find that so admirable that she could combine doing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Howard Barker.
I know.
That to me is the biggest
yeah.
trench possible.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just for that. And you know what? I was reminded of her because last night I saw a show called Terminus with Deirdre O'Connell, who to me is very different from Jen Maxwell, but also a purely stage animal who's just such
right.
a wonderful presence. Usually, I think she's only done like one or two Broadway shows, but such a regular presence. Every time I see her on the cast list, I'm always very happy to see her there. And I'm like, okay, well, no matter what the show is like, there's Deirdre O'Connell in it. There's something for me to, someone for me to look at. And the same thing happened with Jen Maxwell.
Yeah,
yes.
But breathing the stage like Deirdre, there were just those forces that you know, and they did movies and TV too, but never with the impact that they had on stage.
Mm. Right. Actors who blossomed in the physical space.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And interestingly speaking, her younger brother, she was born in North Dakota, grew up there, and not a place that spawned probably a lot of stage animals, as you say. But her younger brother is Richard Maxwell,
right.
the playwright.
I mean,
so from this family, there
I
was
realized
these
that
theater
really,
brains.
Really, like late in the game.
Yeah.
That made the connection.
Yeah.
And what I would say is that she was, I think, very, very, very intelligent. And I think maybe that sort of like those lulls that a career has in the theater could really torture an active mind.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to be someone who's waiting for the phone calls, especially at her elite level.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that was, that affected her about whether or not she was going to continue in the profession.
I wouldn't be at all surprised, yeah. Jan Maxwell, Broadway, and American theater are the poorer for her passing. Now, let's talk about what Peter calls not again syndrome, the tendency of Broadway producers and regional artistic directors to keep coming back to the same short list of plays again and again. On Broadway, The Glass Menagerie and Private Lives have both been revived 7 times, and they're constantly being produced by regional theaters all over America. Likewise, Long Day's Journey Into Night, American Buffalo, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Great plays all, but everyone in the business knows perfectly well why they get done so much. They're small cast plays, which makes them significantly cheaper to produce. Fair enough, I guess. But when producers do decide to spend more money on a show, they're still opting for staple items. I don't even remember the number of times I reviewed A Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and Arcadia in the past decade. What is going on here? Is the theater business so shaky that everybody's afraid to take chances, even with the biggest names in the history of American theater? Why, for example, do we keep getting Lillian Hellman's The Little Foxes and not The Children's Hour? Elizabeth, I know that particular choice really irks you.
Well, actually, yes and no, because I love The Little Foxes, and I could see it a few more times. I've only seen it twice in the past 15 years in New York, so I don't think
That's because you're not out on the road with me.
That's right. But here, twice, I mean, there was a great Eva Van Hove production with Elizabeth Marvel, and then there was the recent one with Cynthia Nixon and Laura Linney, Trading Parts, as Regina. So I could see it again. In fact, I would love to see that German production with Nina Haas that she did
a couple of years ago.
But that said, I would love to see The Children's Hour, which is another Lina Hellman play. It's the one about the lesbian school teachers. Now, it was done in London on the West End a few years ago with Elizabeth Moss and Keira Knightley. And there was a rumor at some point that this would come to Broadway. It didn't happen, I think, for scheduling reasons. But amazingly, this play has never been reviewed on Broadway. And it's gotten maybe like one major Broadway review. I mean, in any case, it's a strikingly low. And
I have never seen The Children's Hour performed in the theater anywhere in America.
Me neither. I've never seen it. I've read it, and I've seen the movie. But I think this play is due for a reevaluation, just exact same way that The Boys in the Band has been rethought and reconsidered, and has kind of gone through the whole cycle of self-loathing, camp admiration, and now actual deep-felt admiration.
And now is about to come back to Broadway.
Yes, exactly. So the timing is good. So, and it's just two great parts. I mean, it's a big show. And I know that Tina Landau has expressed that we had a Twitter exchange where she said she would love to direct it. So I'm putting it out there.
To get to the meat of this question that Terry asks, is the theater business so shaky that everyone's afraid to take chances? The answer is yes.
Yeah.
We have a completely timid business when it comes to taking the leap with work that no one has seen before. And they're getting more and more timid. And part of the problem is there are only two or three bona fide producers who really have an interest in doing new work on Broadway in terms of plays. We have a situation where musicals are such a priority now for the tourist-driven audience of Broadway, which now represents two out of every three seats in Broadway theaters, which is the exact opposite of what it was a generation ago. And we have a situation where writers, playwrights, no longer think of themselves as writing for those size spaces.
Right.
And let's face it, it is a different kettle of fish writing for a play for 1,500, 1,200, 900 people than it is for 250, which is where most regional theaters are situated in terms of size. And these things have all conspired to limit the number of new plays we see on the most prominent and important platform for theater in America, possibly the world. Last season, four new plays, I dare say, of, you know, not all my favorites, but certainly I had favorites among critics and among audiences, Indecent, Sweat, A Doll's House Part 2, and Oslo, for varying reasons, were gone within 4 months of opening, all of them. As if they never existed, in a sense.
And I think the only one that's worked well financially has been The Humans.
And that was a year and a half ago.
Yes, right. Exactly.
And when you couple this with the reluctance to revisit important, famous plays of the past that are not on this short list of stuff we like to do every three seasons, and you've got a recipe for repertory paralysis, and it's not just on Broadway. I mean, it is really happening everywhere.
Right.
Well, I think the problem is that the producers believe in disruption only when it applies to ticket prices. Then they're like really into that. Right. Okay, I'm going to disrupt the market by like charging $900 for not just seats. But the disruption of the model stops. And I think someone who actually is going to be willing to take a risk could really clean up. I deeply believe that.
Interesting. Well,
I'm glad you said that, because it strikes me that what we're needing here is a stiff dose of constructive criticism. So put up or shut up, Elizabeth. Tell us, which over-familiar plays would you like to see put into mothballs, and which ones would you like to see produced in their place?
I'm going to start, for me, a play that I love, but I really do not want to see again for quite a while, is King Lear. Now, of course, Ben is bringing one this spring with Anthony Scher. I will go with an open mind, but my first thought when I thought that programming was like, are you kidding? A Gregory Doran production of King Lear? Oh, that's going to be groundbreaking. Like, we really need to see that one. But I do not understand that thinking. I mean, I understand it because they want to fill seats. And the reality of it is that you'll have a kind of this kind of passive reflex, I guess, of saying, oh, King Lear, all right, well, I'll go see that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I know the story. And it's a great play, and I love seeing it, but do I want to see that again for the next 3 or 4 years? No. No, 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 no. Another one that I have very mixed feelings about is another play that I love, and it's The Glass Menagerie. I love the single production on Broadway. We can discuss that some other time, but I loved it. Do I need to see it again, the play? No. I actually want to see more late period Tennessee, like the really cray-cray Tennessee Williams. I want to see it. You know, train doesn't stop here anymore. I'm going to be the only one saying that. But
the alcoholic Williams.
In playwrights, okay, Tom Stoppard, just stop. Don't stop. That's it. Done. Brecht? Don, oh, he has so many things to say about the times we live in. Shut up. We have heard it. No. You know what? I just come here with that. Do I need to be constructive now? Okay, so you may have deduced from my accent that I am not from these parts. And I would love to
really?
See...
Really? I thought SpongeBob started in Paris.
I was thinking about that, actually, while watching the French ice skaters and their wardrobe malfunction on the Olympics, and I was thinking, oh my god, that is a sponge boob.
Very good.
The worst.
Oh my god. She went there, folks.
She went there. But anyway, we can cut that. But
I'm bummed. No, that's good.
Anyway, so obviously we'd like to see more French playwrights. But in general, playwrights in translation. I would say someone like Jon Fosse, who's amusingly, probably the most produced European playwright at the moment, except he's never done here.
Sense of that over here.
Well, that's what's interesting. You know what's weird also is that Sarah Kane is incredibly popular in Europe, the late Sarah Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult material. She's herself is wildly popular in Europe, and so is Jon Fosse. Here, they are hardly ever produced. Sarah Kane, maybe a little bit, but Jon Fosse, I think I've seen 2 shows by him in the past 15 years in New York. So, but I would say in general, more contemporary plays in translation, and also just, guys, there's a really big catalog out there.
Mm.
Why Shakespeare when you could do Schiller or you know, Odon von Horváth, who's a great Austrian playwright. There's such a rich, I mean, that's what I'm saying, the disruption can come from there, and you can really get attention and just, like, you have a freedom that you don't have with that just...
And I thought that that's sort of what regional theater was set up to do.
Yeah.
I thought the idea partly was that they were supposed to be freed of this kind of, the endless repeating of what everyone else did. I really think that we've lost our way that way. And can I just put a couple of plays into assisted living and let them stay in retirement for a while?
Let's hear your hit list.
Okay. The things I don't want to, I dread seeing again. Maybe they're, not so terrible when you see them, but I just don't, the words send chills up my spine. A Midsummer Night's Dream. I the fairies, I've seen every kind of Titania and Oberon you can possibly imagine. I don't think I can endure it again. As You Like It is another one. Into That Woods again and again and again and again. Theaters go.
Oh, speaking of Into the Woods, I don't need to see that one again.
I would say The Seagull. We do way too many. I think every young theater student thinks they've got a seagull in them, and then when they start a theater company, it's inevitably what they think they should be doing because they got an A on it in drama class. And for modern plays, I've seen enough Noises Off that to last me a lifetime. It seems like it's the default yuck it up show for supposedly theater cognoscenti, but I'm up to my ears. And finally, the August show for a small cast that is the perennial that drives me crazy is Waiting for Godot. I just feel like I've seen that barren tree too many times on too many stages in too many productions.
I want to reassure listeners, especially those who are about to do those shows, that it's not like we're going to go see them and thinking, oh, I'm hating this, I don't want to be there. Because
right.
I think I'm going to speak for all of us. Like, we're going in, every time it's a blank slate. Well, it's not, but it is. And I'm really always, I love being surprised. I love when a production of a show that a chestnut completely reveals something new. But
true.
It's so hard.
But it's the mindset of, it really is psychological about what, it's not so much when you're sitting there watching, it's getting up the energy to go and watch.
Right.
And when you hear these titles, they don't make you want to go. Of course, because we have to go, sometimes it's revelatory in a way you didn't expect. And certainly that is that's the consolation of doing these.
But you're betting against the house if you think you can bring something new to Death of a Salesman.
Right.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure.
Let's talk, we see a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the audience member who goes to the theater once or twice a year, which sadly is the reality. Mm. That's what most people go. Well, maybe they haven't seen 14 King Lears.
Right.
And then it's like, well, this is reassuring in a way. And again, sadly, I think for a lot of people, there's something intimidating about the theater or not, So I think that reassuring peg. So are we balancing, is the reasoning that, well, it's better to do something well-known and get people in? Do well-known properties actually get more butts in the seats? I would love to hear from artistic directors, like, please, guys, email us and tell us, like, have you noticed a difference? Do you get more audiences when you do a well-known Shakespeare than when you take a risk on a young playwright? I would really love to know that.
Well, I'll tell you what they're telling me is that they're afraid increasingly, unless it's a Shakespeare-identified company, they're afraid to do any classic play. They see their numbers go down when they do something like that. The amount of courage it takes even to do a King Lear in the present climate is not inconsiderable. And I do think that we have to keep that in mind. We are speaking, as you say, from the point of view of people who go to see two or three shows a week. And that's an enviable condition to be in. But it also creates a kind of professional deformation that may make us insensitive to the fact that whenever we go to sing King Lear, there are always a couple of hundred people in the audience who've never seen it before. And
but,
that's worth remembering.
Yes, but to thine own self be true.
Yeah,
you're
right.
You have to reflect your own experience as a critic. And making too many allowances for, I think, theatergoers who go twice a year is really getting artistic directors off the hook.
Well,
I really don't think most artistic directors look at their season and go, oh, great, we're doing Death of a Salesman again. I really think that that's, you know, they know that they're conceding part of their artistic credibility in those situations. And, so give them and that goes back to your issue of courage.
What do you want them to do instead? What would you really, what would you open the envelope and say, oh yeah, I want to see this now?
I would take, I would do entire seasons of new plays. I would, I'm not the Shakespeare Theater Company. I would make a commitment to just doing new voices. And I mean, new plays, meaning plays written in the last 5, 6, 7 years. I would do seasons of just Baker and Brandon Jacob Jenkins and Amy Herzog and Susan Laurie Parks. I would just flood the zone, and you know, I would take it the hit the first season, and then I would wait for the audience to catch up with me and find a few decent, supportive, deep-pocketed funders who thought the same way.
Yeah, I think that last bit.
Hey, I can dream. If I'm not going to dream this way, yeah, right.
It happens that I myself am really partial to small cast plays, so I want to mention three that I'd like to see staged much more often. There's first a pair of 4-character plays, Shaw's Don Juan in Hell, and Alan Ayckbourn's Relatively Speaking, and a brilliant 2-hand comedy that I've never seen performed live, David Ives' Ancient History. Any of those shows would add spice to a season, whether on Broadway or elsewhere. And I also want to put forward a different kind of constructive suggestion, which is that regional theaters should try grappling with the problem of presenting more large-scale, large cast, unfamiliar plays by joining forces to co-produce them. I'll give you an example of that kind of approach. In 2012, I saw Once in a Lifetime, which is the very first play by Moss Hart and George S. Kaufman, jointly mounted by ACT in San Francisco and the Aslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Now, nobody does Once in a Lifetime because, like so many American plays of the 30s and 40s, it's just too big. It requires 5 sets and 38 actors, and that's why it hasn't been seen on Broadway since 1979. But ACT and Aslo Rep pooled their resources and did Once in a Lifetime, and both companies also double as drama schools, which makes it possible for them to use student actors to cover the smaller parts. The result is that we got not one, but 2 productions of a rarely seen American comedy classic, and the version that I saw in Sarasota was first rate in every way. Well, we've solved that problem. Let's change the subject and take a quick spin around the table for some hit-and-run opinionizing. What shows have you seen recently that you really liked or really did not like? Peter?
I'll mention one in each category. Just this past week, I was in Washington at the Kennedy Center for yet another revised version of Chess. The musical by Tim Rice, Benny Anderson, and Bjorn Ulvaeus, and it's from the 80s, as you may know. It's a Cold War musical. This had the greatest cast, I think, this season of any musical. It had Raul Esparza, Karen Olivo, Ruthie Ann Miles, and Ramin Karimloo in the leads. It's just a hot cast.
That's a whole bunch of people, yeah.
That's a whole, plus Bryce Pinkham as the arbiter.
Oh my God.
It was really starry and exciting in that regard. It was also a half hour longer than other versions of the musical. They decided it needed more book. This show with book problems needed more book, and they turned it into an even more tediously tract-driven piece. It needs less of that. It needs to be a buoyant concert. It was in concert fashion. It proved to me that this show, and no matter what you do to it, is just a collection of really wonderful music that has no way of making the story work.
I really think, I know my hopes are fading fast, but I still believe that one day there will be a great production of Chess. I want to.
Yeah, no, I love the music.
I love that musical. And
maybe it needs the Candide treatment to junk the book and start from scratch in that department.
I I think so.
Yeah. Well, this is a guy named Danny Strong, a TV writer who made, you know, God love him. He took his shot this time. I don't know how many shows have been through so many permutations as Chess. But on a happier note, that wasn't unhappy, but this is a happier note. I went back to a show that Terry adores, Hello, Dolly.
Oh, and, a great work of American art.
I do believe that.
And I know this is a huge spectrum of opinion here. I'm somewhere in the middle of these two.
I didn't say I didn't like the musical. I don't like that version of the musical.
Oh, my God.
But Bernadette Peters has come in the celebrated Bette Midler slot. And in combination with Victor Garber as Horace Vander Gelder, it's a dream. I loved it. It's tighter. Even, you know, the secondary characters have become more vibrant. It sails through. She's emotional. You know, Bette was wonderful, but it was like, you know, do I care if I marry Horace Vander Gelder? Yeah, who cares? You know, whatever. With Bernadette, it's I want a second chance. And you can feel that sort of, you know, she's speaking to that all through the show. And with Victor Garber, who plays Horace as this big kid, as this goofy big kid, you know, you really do root for them. You're sobbing at the end because it really is an emotional moment when they finally find each other.
Wow.
So those are my choices.
You know, to their credit and to my surprise, they asked me if I would like to come back and see the new cast.
Good for them.
And unfortunately, I'm in Houston and can't quite manage that except by the transporter tube. But you tempt me.
Oh, my God.
Elizabeth.
I have been traveling, so I've seen a few things, but nothing that I loved and would want to praise. But I did see something that... it's getting a lot of attention because it's got a wonderful cast. That's a public theater. It's a play called Kings. And
yes,
I thought it was so poor. Oh. Are you saying yes because you liked it? Because, okay.
Now we're talking.
I don't think we have FCC restrictions. So I'm going to reference two things that come up in the play. There's mention of a shit taco and there's mention of sizzling fajitas. And on a scale from shit taco to sizzling fajita, this play...
I know which way it's going for you.
The needle is going towards the shit taco.
It's another sponge boob.
It's another... Whoa, no, but I really enjoy sponge boob, so... SpongeBob. Losing my mind. Okay, what a disappointment that is. I have mixed feelings about, like, it's by a woman named Sarah Burgess. Was it Burgess?
Burgess.
Burgess. She had on a play called Dry Powder a couple of years ago in the public. Not, you know, like, a lot of potential. Not quite there, but potential. And this one is also at the public, and it takes place, it's very of the moment. It takes place among politicians and lobbyists. It's four characters. Cass is great. Aya Cash, who's always wonderful. Gillian Jacobs, who's kind of coming back to the stage, the always reliable Zach Grenier, and Isa Davis. And the writing is so woman-splainy and flat, and the acting from people that I love is so tentative and awkward. I never believed for a second in Aya Cash, and it's not even that. It's that I did not believe in Aya Cash and especially Gillian Jacobs as this hard-beating lobbyist. I was just like, no, I'm sorry,
and,
no.
And I liked it.
And you
I did. I liked it.
Oh, God.
I liked it. I loved that it was about an issue that people need to hear about, which is
sure.
How money is running the government. And I thought it really, you know, the idea, just the mere idea that you could theatricalize the notion of carried interest as a legislative issue.
I think we're going to disagree on whether it was theatricalized.
Well, remember, I'm a policy wonks a lot of my time in D.C., so it may be a D.C. play.
Well, the show that did not ring the bell for me is Fire and Air.
Oh my God, it's so bad.
You were going to mention that, Elizabeth, so I wanted to trip you again. It's his play about Diaghilev and Nijinsky, and it's a...
Where was it?
It just does not work.
CSC.
I don't think. It's not a convince. It's not doesn't convince me on any level. And again, this is a particular area of interest for me, and it may simply be that I'm responding to the play I wish I were seeing rather than what I saw. But even allowing for that, I don't think that it engages, and I haven't talked to anybody who was really engaged by it. On the other hand, I saw and was dazzled by Martin McDonagh's Hangmen, which is playing at the Atlantic Theater, and there are rumbles that it might go elsewhere from there.
Right, there is Broadway talk.
It should. I mean, it's not just a matter of good timing. The timing being that it's coming out at the very moment when Three Billboards in Ebbing, Missouri is getting Oscar talk. I think it's one of the strongest things he's given us. I think it's comparable in quality to Three Billboards. I think it is an absolutely prime candidate for a Broadway transfer. And I think maybe, I mean, you wouldn't want to interfere with his cast. It's a tight ensemble cast. And you wouldn't want to drag in some screen star just to give it Broadway credibility. But I think because of the Three Billboards buzz, they might be able to get it to Broadway as is. And I would love to see that happen. And I will have to leave it at that.
I just want to interject that tomorrow I'm seeing Hangman at the matinee and Hello Dolly in the evening. And
oh, talk about boxing the compass.
I really feel lucky. And there's no irony in this. I feel like the luckiest woman in the world to be able to see these two shows in a day.
Well, the clock says it's time to drop the curtain on this episode. So, Elizabeth, come back in 2 weeks and tell us about this experience, at which time we will be bringing you another podcast that we hope is full of interesting talk, challenging ideas, and a fair amount of disagreement. Until then, I'm Terry Teachout.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Peter Marks, and you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York and Houston about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate.
You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle, spelled out, and write to us at Three on... Sorry, let me do that again.
At.
You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle, spelled out, and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com.
Let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you on the Isle.